countries that are out and out, you know, dissenting from U.S. hegemony, say Bolivia, you fund these organizations that basically raise the alarm that the country is heading toward dictatorship, and it manipulates the press. I mean, you know, in Bolivia, the reason why that coup didn't take hold is because Evo Morales kicked out AID.
And you also have, for example, Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive saying among the most infamous examples of USAID funding was the Office of Public Safety, a USAID police training program in the Southern Cone that also trained torturers. We only have 20 seconds. It's not your total focus, but your thoughts on how it's been used.
I mean, I don't have doubt that it's been used that way. I have no evidence of that. It's certainly in the conversation in South Africa, for example. People would make those accusations and be frustrated about that. But I'm more interested in the way that this kind of agency shuts down South Africa's ability to solve its own problems. And
I think that is key,
and
we're going to link to the articles you write. Professor Catherine Mathers at Duke University, thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m., KBOO makes everything metal. The Metal March returns again in 2025, featuring 10 hours of live bands and DJ sets from your favorite KBOO metal hosts. March 4th and support metal on KBOO. Text KBOO to 44321 or go to kboo.fm/give to donate and tune in to the Metal March Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m. through Saturday, March 15th at 6 a.m. Metal takes over the airwaves for the Metal March Metal Marathon, only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Are you interested in learning to report on your community? Consider joining the volunteer KBOO News Team. We train volunteers on journalism, ethics, and radio storytelling. Check it out. Come to our virtual volunteer orientation on Saturday, March 8th at 11 a.m. Find more information at kboo.fm/volunteer. That's kboo.fm/volunteer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, with Medicaid in the budget crosshairs, an Oregon congresswoman speaks out in the nation's capital. Cuts are impacting hundreds of workers in Oregon. We hear from one about how they're affecting our federal lands and parks. And a change could be coming to where the funds from the homelessness tax end up. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 6, 2025. I am Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. In the nation's capital, an Oregon congresswoman asked a Medicaid expert about Republican plans to cut Medicaid and how they could impact people in our state and all across the country. Here's part of that exchange as Congresswoman and Dr. Maxine Dexter talked to Cody Kinsley, who is currently North Carolina's Health and Human Services Secretary.
I'm a pulmonary and critical care doctor, and that's my background. For 17 years, I took care of patients in Oregon at the most critical times, their greatest need. It's their stories that I carry with me in this advocacy. It is imperative that we understand the impact these Medicaid cuts that Republicans are leveraging will have on people, our states, and our healthcare systems, including our hospitals. So can you please explain what these Republican Medicaid cuts will do to hospitals and also our children's hospitals?
Absolutely. Thank you. North Carolina has had nearly a dozen hospitals close in rural parts of our state in the decade leading up to expansion. And that makes sense. We have a disproportionate number of people living in rural communities that had historically been uninsured. Medicaid expansion changed that. Expansion made possible for those folks to get covered. And now 25% of our Medicaid enrollees live in rural North Carolina. So it's just simple math. If people walk through the front door of any business, they don't have a way to pay. And what businesses do in these hospitals is they start to jack up the prices of everybody else, whether you're on private insurance or private pay. But eventually that's unsustainable. And then they also just have to choose to shutter. It also leads to more consolidation in the health system, which also drives up prices. Medicaid expansion keeps these hospitals open. Medicaid broadly keeps these hospitals open, and it also gives the foundation for more competition in our healthcare system that can help drive down costs overall.
Thank you. And it's clear that far too many people in our country and in my district struggle with mental health challenges and addiction. Portland has clearly been in the news for that. What will Republican Medicaid cuts mean for access to affordable mental health and addiction treatment?
I came home to North Carolina in 2018 with the passion to make a difference on behavioral health. We were fighting the opioid epidemic. We brought coalitions of people together. And we heard over and over again from sheriffs saying, we are not going to arrest our way out of this problem. We need different tools to make a difference. And I will say it was a lot of that energy that brought together the coalition of sheriffs and law enforcement that said, we need Medicaid expansion. The people who are getting stuck in the gap, who are rotating through jails and prison, when 60% of people in incarcerated settings have a substance use disorder, when they're rotating through, we need a different tool that looks like pre-arrest diversion, Medicaid-assisted treatment, reentry supports. If you don't have a way to pay for these services, then people get stuck in these cycles. And in the end, that cost is borne by our law enforcement. That cost is borne by our local communities. Nothing is free. We just need to put the money in the place where it makes a difference. And Medicaid makes possible for us to invest in prevention and to lower costs, save lives, and get productive taxpayers into the community.
I agree completely. Thank you very much.
And that was part of a hearing today in the U.S. House about Medicaid. As the Portland metro region continues to grapple with houselessness, Metro Council President Lynn Peterson is proposing allowing some homeless tax revenue to go directly to cities. Right now, Metro only provides the funds to Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties. Peterson talked to Multnomah County Commissioners this week about how the funding is making a difference.
The counties and the cities in partnership with Metro are making real progress. The three counties have done incredible work in the first few years, placing more than 6,000 households in housing, preventing nearly 16,000 evictions in our region, and funding almost 2,000 shelter beds. Multnomah County, by far, has the highest population of people in need of those services. And the need has only grown over the last 5 years because of compounding effects of pandemic and increased inflow into homelessness. And while we should celebrate our successes, I think we can all agree that we all need to do better, both to meet the need and public confidence in our efforts. Inflow into homelessness is exceeding the ability of Multnomah County to end chronic homelessness. The most recent local tax increases, coupled with government's inability to deliver the services that it promised to voters, has created conditions where high-income earners who fund SHS do not think they are getting the value for the taxes they pay. Seemingly, everyone agrees that housing and homelessness are our biggest priorities. So that is where Metro is spending its time and effort. We are simply asking the county to join us in that effort to do better. And until we can reform how we deliver the services to our most vulnerable, we will continue to see slower than expected growth or even outright declines in SHS revenue. During the first 3 years of implementation, counties were busy building the system capacity to deliver the services at a scale that is sustainable. but doing so with such a volatile revenue source has proved very difficult. This measure was born out of crisis, and people wanted to move fast to end homelessness. As a community, we believe this crisis could be solved and solved quickly with enough money. No one anticipated a pandemic, an economic crisis that led to more homelessness and housing instability for thousands across our region. It's time we deal with this reality and stop the excuses and do better together for the people of Multnomah County and the whole region. In moving fast as a region to be responsive to the need, we missed some financial, technical, and political risks and opportunities. We did not adequately answer questions about the goals of the region for this program and other resources that we would need to meet it. We did not define roles and responsibilities clearly. And in Multnomah County, with the largest homeless population, we collectively did not look to manage a system, but instead worked to fund existing specific programs which are helping people and individuals but are not achieving that shared regional goals. And the county's been managing a lot of risk without the partners in the state and local arena to bring in experts to help manage those risks. County staff and electeds were not used to being part of a conversation with Metro. We are new into this space, and I want to acknowledge that. And that has created a little bit of distrust that we need to continually manage through, because Metro is here to help, not to hurt.
And that was Metro Council President Lynn Peterson speaking to Multnomah County commissioners this week. Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley led a roundtable talk with other U.S. senators and fired National Parks workers who were casualties of Trump budget cuts. Merkley and other leaders are promising they'll fight for the workers.
You've worked so hard to get to where you are in life, and then just out of nowhere, lightning bolt comes, and you're told your job is no longer there. That means a lot of anxiety and a lot of stress, a lot of uncertainty. And adding insult to it all is the way that many of you were notified. A piece of paper or an email telling you have been terminated for performance failures when your record of public service has been settled. Let me just say, you are my heroes. You have a passion for public service. You're serving to make the public lands just the best they could possibly be as ecosystems, as part of the economy of grazing or logging and recreation. So just know that in the eyes of millions of Americans, you're our heroes. It's not right or fair. And we don't even believe it's legal in the way that you have been treated. So I want you to know you have champions here in D.C. who care about you, who have your back, and who are fighting to get this reversed, having folks come forward and say there's no support for this across the country and it has to be changed. We believe that the terminations are not only horrific for all of you, but they're going to have devastating impacts on our public lands.
And one of the fired workers who spoke out during the nationwide discussion is from Oregon. Bailey Langley describes what happened to her.
I worked in public affairs for the Umatilla National Forest, also supporting the Malheur and Willow Whitman National Forests on the revision of their land management plan. My primary responsibility was to inform and engage Eastern Oregon communities as well as the American public and assist the public in their understanding of federal laws and regulations, allowing them to actively participate in the process and have a part in how the Forest Service managed these national forests. On Friday, February 14th, I was wrongfully terminated by the U.S. Forest Service and the Office of Personnel Management, 52 days from the end of my probationary period, effective immediately, and asked to gather my belongings and leave. It was and has been a heartbreaking process. Working for the agency as a public service servant was not only a privilege, but it was a community of folks who had a purpose and desire to produce services and goods for the American people, and to have your livelihood, community, a piece of your identity, and your future wrongfully taken from you. I did what you were supposed to do, attend a four-year university, move to get my dream job, serve my community, and then it was all taken away. After a few days of shock of what had occurred, that's when the realization had started to set in. The realization that this administration directly targeted working class Americans with the least working protections, and that this was a blanket butchering of employees who are hired to sustain the agencies into the future. These three national forests primarily serve our nation's ranchers and agricultural communities. Our offices are located and employ some of the most rural towns in Oregon, who also rely largely on the public lands to sustain their livelihoods, firewood to heat their homes, sustaining the Forest Service, sustaining habitat for fish and elk that feed their families, collecting huckleberries that are important to the four surrounding tribes, grazing allotments for their cattle and sheep. Without the proper workforce, folks should expect that national forests and land management agencies will not be able to provide them the goods and services they have a right to from their public lands. My team of five was reduced to a team of two in a matter of 2 days. And I believe that in total, these three national forests alone lost roughly 65 to 70 employees. In rural towns where Forest Service offices are one of the largest employers who provide solid benefits and pay, it will and it has had detrimental consequences.
Cuts are looming for Washington State's tribal public health funding. The Tribal Foundational Public Health Service allots money from Olympia for tribes to fund public health initiatives. But as Isabel Charlet reports, the service now faces budget cuts, which could create more public health challenges.
Washington State's Tribal Foundational Public Health Service is the first dedicated funding for tribes to advance public health initiatives. In Governor Bob Ferguson's proposed budget, it faces the risk of losing crucial funding. Jessica McKee is with the American Indian Health Commission, which serves on the Tribal FPHS Steering Committee. She says after the state increased funding for the service in the last biennium to $200,000 per year per tribe, some tribes were able to create their first dedicated public health position. She says cuts to the service would be a blow.
They might not be able to maintain their public health person anymore, and that's a big deal.
McKee says the tribal FPHS funds foundational aspects of public health, such as tracking maternal and child health, environmental health, and communicable disease surveillance. With a recently confirmed measles case in King County, McKee is concerned that potential loss of funding for tribal FPHS coupled with the Trump administration's policies on immunizations could create a significant public health challenge.
If those funding streams are to be cut on top of people being vaccine hesitant, we could have a perfect storm of MMR breakouts all over the place.
McKee says a strength of the tribal FPHS is that the funding is flexible and each tribe chooses its own public health priorities. Some tribes may be able to expand existing efforts such as training clinic staff in infection prevention. Others may use new resources to hire public health staff to write health codes.
It is one of the opportunities for funding that really feels like it's honoring tribal sovereignty. And that's not always the case with funding.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, clear skies down to an overnight low of 35. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy up to 54. Today in history, on this date in 1475, Michelangelo was born. Probably the greatest of the Italian Renaissance artists. Our quote of the day is from Michelangelo. A man paints with his brains and not with his hands. The clock is running out toward mid-month up against a federal budget deadline, and one of the leading negotiators is from the Pacific Northwest. Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray plays a big role as the leading Democrat on appropriations in the Senate. She says so much is at stake right now. Here's part of a recent speech to fellow senators.
No one wants a shutdown. Actually, no one except Elon Musk, who recently said that sounds great, or Donald Trump or Russ Vogt. That is why I have been at the table, ready to pass a bill that protects key investments and makes sure that Congress, not Donald Trump or Elon Musk, decides whether or not our public schools or our life-saving cancer research gets funded. Unfortunately, Republican leadership told their members to walk away from the negotiating table, which raises the risk of a shutdown in an attempt to pass a clean, year-long continuing resolution that would actually give Trump and Musk exactly what they want: fewer restraints and more power over federal spending so they can pick winners and losers as they see fit, which would hurt all of our constituents. I am urging Republican leadership to come back to the table and work with us on full-year funding bills, the type of work we do together every year and prevent a shutdown. We cannot stand by and accept a year-long power grab CR that would help Elon take a chainsaw to programs that families rely on, like yours, or keeps our agencies together that keep our communities safe. We actually have a job to do here, Republicans and Democrats, to be a voice for our constituents, to advocate for the funding that they need, and to get support back to our communities. I have heard my House Republican colleagues say they will not restrict a Republican president's powers. What I'm asking for is to work together to make sure, as we write and negotiate these full-year spending bills, our laws get followed. I welcome, and I want everyone to know, I'm open to any and all ideas about how we can work together to do that. I am confident we can get this done. I'm ready to pass a short-term CR immediately to take down the risk of a shutdown so that we can finish our negotiations and write our full-year spending bills, which is our job to do. We need far more information and transparency and accountability from the Trump administration in order to write these bills. How are we supposed to fund the government when many of our agencies today are not responding to our questions, and we have no picture, clear picture, of what is actually or who is actually in charge of many of our agencies? It is clear as day there have been a lot of dramatic changes made across the government. Agencies are being illegally shuttered. Workers are being fired by the thousands, often in direct violation of laws we passed, and hundreds of billions of dollars in federal programs and grants have been frozen, unfrozen, frozen again. We've had contracts that have been recklessly canceled, some accidentally and then restarted, not to mention the workers that were fired and rehired. It is incredibly chaotic, and it makes it much harder to write our legislation that actually responds to these latest developments when programs are switching on and off again like a two-year-old is playing with a light switch. It is much more difficult to write funding bills for department programs when we have no idea what the department is actually doing or what the actual plan is for next year, or it's actually them or perhaps DOGE making the plans in the first place. When we are seeing decisions made and reversed, made and ignored, made by people who have no authority to make them, and yet seemingly being implemented, and it's not just the whirlwind of decisions that are causing this chaos, it is the complete lack of transparency and accountability surrounding these decisions from Trump and Musk that makes it all but impossible to get a straight answer. When we have questions that urgently need answers, like why has this energy program been frozen? Or when will the NIH grants start up again? Or which VA contracts have actually been scrapped? Or how many workers have been pushed out? Then it helps if we know who's actually in charge. When our constituents have problems that require solutions quickly, or they will have to close a business, or lay people off, or lose their family farm, then it matters that we can get the right person on the phone to get things resolved. When there is information we urgently need so we can write our funding bills and avoid a shutdown, like agency priorities or unexpected challenges or just the basic nuts and bolts of stuff, to say nothing of the information we need to address the very extraordinary circumstances and decisions of the past few weeks, it is totally unclear who we should actually be talking to if we want answers that actually reflect the reality of what's happening. It is totally unclear who is actually making these decisions and who is actually in charge. Appropriators have now sent over 30 letters to agencies since January 20th asking to just understand agency actions. And that's to say nothing of the efforts from me and my staff to get answers to our emails and our calls. But the answers have been few and very far between. And what's more, just because we hear something from someone who should know, just because we hear from someone who should be in charge, we have found that does not mean it's actually true. More than one time in the past few weeks where we've been told one thing, only to see the reality is entirely different. For example, when the OMB funding freeze was implemented and we were told it won't affect Head Start. except that it did affect Head Start. Providers in my state were locked out of that payment system for days, even after the funding freeze itself was rescinded. It seems like the only thing that has been consistent about the last few weeks is that every time there's been chaos, every time I see actions that fly in the face of laws we have passed, not to mention common sense, or contradict what I have heard from agency leaders, DOGE has been at the center of it. We have seen DOGE absolutely trample the authority of Congress and other federal agencies, including officials Congress confirmed. For example, while Secretary Rubio instituted a recklessly broad and illegal freeze of all foreign assistance funding, he publicly announced exceptions for a limited set of programs, including life-saving aid. The basic idea being that we probably shouldn't let HIV spread rampant, and we probably shouldn't let food grown right here in America rot in ports while children starve. Causing mass death through pointless negligence is not really a good strategy for bolstering our global reputation. It is cruel and it is self-defeating. So as Secretary of State, he made the exception. But DOGE had other plans, because on the rare occasion that what was left of USAID staff who had not been sidelined was able to clear these payments through the agency's interim leadership, surprise, DOGE staffers would veto those payments anyway. Congress and the American people we represent should not be out of the loop.
Some corporations are accused of squeezing out independent farmers, and immigration lawyers say Hispanic drivers are being stopped based on how they look, with more in the stories impacting our democracy. Here's 2025 Talks.
This is going to affect everybody. People aren't using these program dollars to go to Disneyland. They're using them to go to the dentist and to seek primary care services.
Rick Lucas, president of the Ohio Nurses Association, warns that the Medicaid cuts in the budget outline passed by Republicans in the House will hit the working poor in rural health care especially hard. A pause in some of President Donald Trump's tariffs has stopped 2 days of sliding stock prices. The administration says the auto industry will be exempt for a month. Markets rose on the news. Trump has issued what he says is a last warning for Hamas, demanding the immediate release of hostages in Gaza and vowing full support for Israel to, quote, finish the job. His statement came as the White House is under fire for holding what it has confirmed are direct negotiations with a group officially designated as a terrorist organization. Republican senators told tech billionaire and Trump advisor Elon Musk that his moves to slash government staffing and spending will require congressional approval. Lawmakers proposed a legislative path to make the cuts permanent, which Musk reportedly embraced. Congress is also facing the threat of a government shutdown next week. Independent farmers warn that corporate control of food production is squeezing them out. Justin Perkins, publisher of Barn Raiser, says just four companies dominate the U.S. livestock industry.
These corporate monopolies are structured all across the agriculture industry, and this has made the livelihood of small and even medium-sized farmers nearly untenable.
Large agriculture firms argue they've made food production more efficient and kept prices low, but critics say concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, pollute air and water in surrounding communities. Immigration lawyers say they're looking at due process issues under Trump's mass deportation plans. Elliot Ramirez with the Indianapolis firm Greskin Singleton says many immigrants don't know their rights, fueling fear and uncertainty in the Latino community.
People don't know that they have rights. People are afraid that ICE or the police are going to show up to their home and take their family away. We're also hearing a lot of people getting pulled over for they have a tail light out or they look suspicious.
Trump moves to dismantle the Department of Education would append Virginia school budgets. According to teachers' union estimates, it would leave the state with a $2.5 billion funding gap. I'm Farah Siddiqui.
Rural Alaskan school students suffer from chronic underfunding. And a study finds prairie dogs are key to conserving America's grasslands. For these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez in National Native News.
Emily Schwing spent the last year crawling through attics, basements, and classrooms in rural public schools across Alaska. What she found was a serious public health and safety crisis that's impacting Alaska's indigenous students.
There's no mechanism to condemn a building in Alaska, but in the tiny community of Sleepmute,
That's exactly what an architect recommended for the public school back in 2021. Angela Hayden is the lead teacher.
The roof was leaking when I first started teaching here 17 years ago.
That leak has been left for nearly two decades. Today, the building is on the verge of collapse. There are bats living in a utility closet and black mold throughout the walls and ceilings. Superintendent Madeline Aguilar says kids can't thrive in these conditions.
They're not conducive for high expectations. They're not conducive for academic achievement. They're not conducive for athletic achievement.
It's not just sleep mute. Dozens of rural public schools in Alaska face similar problems, and the health risks are concerning. Long-term exposure to black mold can irritate lungs and cause chronic fatigue and neurological problems. Fungal spores from bat feces can also irritate lungs and cause blindness. Higher rates of health disparities among Alaska Natives have long been documented compared to the general population, and the majority of students in Alaska's rural public schools are Indigenous. Education Commissioner Dina Bishop acknowledges the public health concern, but says her agency isn't solely responsible.
If something's happening in the school, it's most likely happening in other buildings in the community. It is a collective Alaskan issue that we'd be happy to have a seat at the table to discuss.
Andrea John has three kids enrolled in Sleep Mute, and she says she thinks it's easy for the state to forget communities like hers.
Those city people, they wouldn't let their kids go to school here. They're choosing to look the other way instead of house us.
Emily Schwing reports for KYUK. A candlelight vigil is planned in Mesa, Arizona for Emily Pike, a Native American teenager who disappeared in January. She was staying at a group home in the city. Police recently confirmed some of her remains were discovered on a remote highway last month. Multiple agencies are now involved in the investigation, the Arizona Republic reports. Her family and the San Carlos Apache tribe, where she's from, are asking for privacy. American grasslands were once a mecca for biodiversity, but federal data shows more than 60% of the ecosystem has vanished due to agriculture, development, and invasive species. New research shows how the Mountain West region could play a role in the conservation of one important